coaching, right? You may be a very expert beginner, but you're still a beginner. You know what? You might have a Leonardo da Vinci understanding of program design, but you literally just don't have the hours of and the repetitions seeing it and seeing different people in different positions. So pattern recognition takes time to develop. But in that has been lost this art of communication, of mm-hmm. teaching, of transmitting information. And what you'll see is that there's more and more conversation about being good at that.
Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Uncharted Performance Podcast. How are you doing, man?
I'm well, man. Thanks to you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Been a follower, a fan for quite some time. It's kind of unreal that having a podcast kind of lets you get up and close, you know, quote unquote, with some of the people that you followed and kind of studied and learned from. So it's a very cool experience for me to be able to do this.
Let me just say straight up, the only reason I'm a coach is to get to hang out with the best and brightest brains on the planet. I mean, I get it. It's, you know, we're like, it's like, you know, you're like, how do I become in the secret club of smart people?
That is so true. That is so true. You have done quite a number of podcasts. I will try to keep this as entertaining as hopefully as I can, and maybe ask you some questions you have not been asked before. It's going to be a difficult job for me, but I'll try to do my best. But I want to kick it off with actually that question. Is there a question that you have never been asked that you like, why hasn't anybody asked me this question yet? They're like searching for the unasked question.
No, I think where we are right now, or what I am in my thinking is really trying to wrap around. I think that if the place to dive in is, where are you thinking? What are you thinking about? Mm-hmm. Right? What set of problems are you trying to solve this day? And I think if we can get coaches to start asking themselves in these higher level, like, what are you working on? You know, that when I go to the conferences all the time, one of the things that I'm always amused by is when coaches give lectures, they give, and you can tell they've been doing it for a decade or they've been using the same set. Like, I'm like, that's great. Like, you lecturing on what you're the best in the world at is important. It's important for context for that, but I can go do my research on that. What I want to know is, what are you thinking about today? What are you working on today? Because that's really showing us the evolution. And not, of course, not a conference is going to hear the answer to that. Mm. But that's really the interesting thing. I think, you know, what are you working on? What are you interested in? And I think that really begets a lot of interesting conversations.
All right, so I'm gonna steal from you. And ask you that question. So what problems are you trying to solve right now? What are you interested in right now?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, over the last 10 years, I mean, we've put out, you know, I think we're like 4,000 videos. Mm-hmm. You know, our fifth book, fifth release is coming out, and fifth release in 5 years. So we'll be out here in just another month. And, you know, we're trying to constantly refine how we give information out and how we help coaches solve their own problems. And where I feel like the greater strength and conditioning, we have not done a good job of late, is to show people what compensation looks like. Because I think that there's a lot of talk in the world about how we, you know, theoretically how we should train, what it should look like, but we're not doing a good job of saying, okay, you know, we all can identify where we're limited in terms of strength, or cardiorespiratory demand, or conditioning, or metabolic pathways, but we have to stop training people in shapes of compensation, because what we're really doing is passing the buck along and waiting for that problem to become someone else's problem. Just because your athlete doesn't get hurt and continues to make progress does not mean that you are doing them the service of strength and conditioning, which is reinforcing fundamental, you know, physiology about what the architecture says is the best function for the athlete. And what's happening now is, because the tide has risen so much and we're seeing so many people get stronger and so much fitter, we're able to have this conversation now. And it's a conversation, frankly, we couldn't have a decade ago, because not everyone was deadlifting. I mean, you know, when we started our gym 13 years ago now, this month, and
congratulations.
Thank you. We realized that, like, 13 years ago, you couldn't buy kettlebells in San Francisco. Like, that's not hyperbole. We had to drive to Santa Cruz to buy kettlebells. You couldn't, you know, I mean, like, you, mm-hmm. if you can maybe get them shipped from Russia, you know, you get Pavel's kettlebells, but that's how the world has changed. Now you can literally buy them at Walmart, right? So the world has changed and people are working out harder. Now we can have the next conversation, but what we have not done a good job of is helping coaches understand that when we reinforce compensation, we set up a whole host of problems that has to be solved or addressed later on. And one of the issues is for human beings is that we are not good at thinking in terms of context and in terms of long-term progress. We're interested in very short-term. And that short-term is even a year. But I'm talking about what's the scope of your athletic life look like when you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. I mean, mm-hmm. I think if you've read Yuval Harari's book, Sapiens, for example, you know, and his follow-up book is called Homo Deus, you're going to realize that we're all going to be 100 years old. Like, we have the technology. And the question is, what kind of function do you want at 100? And then that really begins the question, what is it we need to do? What kind of inputs do we need to have so that we can come out of this high-intensity exercise experiment unharmed and that we can really continue to, you know, say, hey, this is what the movement choices we made and the strategies we use and the technique we use, not only to lift the most weights, but because it was the best for the joint and it transferred to the most positions for the longest. And I think when we start thinking those terms, then we can start making different decisions about the way that the athlete finds themselves in the environment. And Greg Cook does a good job of talking about either, you know, look, we need a few more steps between the squat rack and the stethoscope. And I think what he's pointing out is that sometimes we have people, we have a toxic organism in a healthy environment, or we have a healthy organism in a toxic environment. And by toxic, I mean, you know, we don't move enough, we don't eat, we don't sleep, right? That's the kind of thing that we've got to have to unravel some of these things. And I think we're hustling down, hurtling down this interesting path where the role of strength and conditioning can become more and more important because we're doing less these days that supports the health of the organism.
All right, couple.
We have more challenges that.
Got it. I want to actually pull on a few threads based on what you just, several things you just mentioned. The first one being refining information. How have you refined the way you deliver and how you communicate over the years?
Well, you know, you can see is, you know, when we put out the first edition of Supple Leopard, mm-hmm. the principles were there. But the second edition of Supple Leopard, for example, we realized that, hey, we have to speak in terms of absolutes in the terms of showing people how full range of motion is expressed as starting positions and finishing positions in their movements. So, you know, if you look at our language of using archetypes to describe the start positions and finish position shapes of athletic movement, especially formal athletic movement, becomes easy then to sort of unravel the complexity of why can't this person get into a squat? What's limiting this overhead? And so one of the things that we're, you know, as we get better at our job, we can say things like, hey, look, all good models have to be explanatory, predictive, and repeatable. So how is your, show me the theory underpinning your squat mechanics. How does it predict movement compensation? How does it predict performance when you have missing hip internal rotation or missing dorsiflexion? How does that tight rectus femoris, you know, predict movement running, right? How does, you know, and then can I repeat it and then see these patterns in other places? So, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do is really help to get to the bottom so that we can get to the important questions earlier. And then try to do a better job of conjoining positional competency with the stimulus for adaptation. So as we move more effectively, mm-hmm. right, we make positions and positional quality part of that conversation. So, for example, if we say things, like mechanics are the heart of our program, right? Okay, well, that's true. How do you challenge mechanics? Well, we can challenge it with load. We challenge it with speed. We can use cardiorespiratory demand. Here, sprint on this treadmill, then come over and show me you can get your trunk organized, right? I can compete. I can add a lot of stress to that thing. I can change the motor demands. I can say, instead of doing 5, we're going to do 20. So there's a lot of ways where I can challenge your positions. And ultimately, for us, the athlete who has the most robust positioning under the most circumstances is going to be the most successful.
How do you, you mentioned that you've essentially provided the universe with 4,000 videos, a number of titles. How do you determine what you're going to present to the audience next?
Well, you know, what we, you know, first and foremost is that I'm a user. I coach. I mean, right before, the reason we're on at this time and not earlier is that I'm coaching. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in the world working a lot. You know, I just, for our own podcast, we're working on this next season, talking about pain and chronic pain mm-hmm. on the Ready State. And yesterday I got to have a conversation with a very old mentor of mine and someone I look up to named Stu McGill. Okay. And, you know, and one of the things that we talked about was, you know, this notion of being transparent and the notion of, you know, making sure that when we say, does your model predict, when that we say that, that means it has to predict and account for phenomenon across cohorts. And that means specifically that at a granular level, that means that I have to be able to teach, you know, I had a 16 or 17 year old girl in my class today. Mm-hmm. And the principles that I teach her for the dumbbell snatch and for running are the same principles that I'll scale up and refine when I'm working in the NBA or the NFL, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that we always want to say is, you know, we are working alongside and next to the best coaches in the hardest programs, solving the hardest problems. And this is our laboratory. So, you know, you know, I don't know how many gold medals we have and how many Olympic medals we have and how many national medals we have and national championships we have, world championships. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. And I get to work alongside those programs, and I'm clearly not taking credit for their success, but I'm a part of that program and part of those conversations. And what we want to make sure that people understand is that we're seeing the problems at the highest levels of sports and performance, and we're also seeing the problems of the day-to-day. We're seeing what it looks like when moms and dads are having problems, inefficiencies, you know, mechanical pain. And so what we're doing is we continue to try to solve problems. So when you look at, you know, a lot of coaches and even, you know, young physios say, hey, look, I want to, you know, how do I start a business? And I think the easiest way to answer that question is to say, well, what problems do you see that you can help people solve? Because that's actually a good mechanism for solving businesses. You know, I mean, that's a mechanism for a successful business. If I, you know, listen to your podcast and it helps me in my job become more efficient, then I'm going to listen to that podcast and I will pay for that podcast. And that's literally what we try to do is we're trying to talk about and be transparent in our models so that we can help people become better at their jobs.
So speaking of solving problems and actually tying back into the topic of identifying compensation and, you know, being able to spot kind of the athlete or the individual in their compensation, is there, I guess, a process using business jargon? Is there a process flow to be able a coach to be able to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And for us, as we have written about now in every book that we do, it's called Spine First. So can you spot compensation around the spine? You know, and one of the simple models that we use for looking at complex movement is saying, hey, look, you know, if you're disorganized around the trunk, and that's from head to sacrum trunk, then it's going to be really difficult for us to understand what's happening at your knee or ankle, you know, because there are lots of compensatory mechanisms. And so we can look then at how you're organizing the spine and trunk before you engage in a complex movement. We look at the structure, the position, the architecture, but then also we can begin to ask the question, well, can you breathe in that shape? Can you stabilize and breathe in that shape? And then being able to then retool whatever movements we're doing. So if I'm watching someone do push-ups in my gym and they've got a hinge in their low back and they're overextended, you know, and their head is cranked back, that's not a push-up, right? Those are a bunch of compensated positions. And what's going to happen is that we're going to see people ultimately default to their level of training. So the way that you do one thing is going to be the way you do everything. Mm. People have been talking about this forever. So that if we're really going to try to get to the bottom and get, don't get me wrong, there's no such thing as perfect, but there is a such thing as, hey, I make movement mistakes. And my job is to be able to identify those myself and correct them. But what we've sold people is as long as you do the movement, it will take care of itself. And that is not the case. And so, you know, what we say is, you know, if when you look at the development of a child, for example, a child is going to probably practice a skill upwards of 10,000 times before that becomes an integrated skill. 10,000 times. And so that's 10,000 sit-ups. And we have a lot of tolerance in our bodies to learn a new skill because the mechanics of the human being are so robust. But then all of a sudden when you've herniated a disc, when you've got huge bony osteophytes and your movement tolerance goes down, and you become stiff because you're a heavy drinker and you're stressed out and don't warm up or cool down, you know, what's going to happen is, you know, you're going to set yourself up for a situation where you can no longer compensate. And what we have to do is begin to give people, and if I refer to my friend Greg Cook again, you know, some movement vital signs. We don't have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And certainly, but let me give you an example of how this works at a real level. So yes. one of my senseis, my teachers, is a guy named Mike Bergner. Mm-hmm. Mike Bergner is a high-level Olympic lifting coach who has children who've been Olympians. Yes. He's been an Olympic lifting coach. Like he's a solid lifting coach, but he also spent decades teaching Olympic lifting at a high school. And one of the things that he did is, when you look at his model, he always starts the coach or the athlete from the hang position. Why? Because it, you know, that's the position of that's closest to standing. It's the position where we're going to see few amount of positions of compensation, that you can get the spine in a pretty organized shape. And then he goes to muscle snatches and power snatches first. And so he teaches these complex movements in ranges of motion where you're going to see very little compensation. And that means that he can get people Olympic lifting in positions where their biomechanics and underdeveloped motor control doesn't get them into problems. And that's a good example of why we can teach everyone to snatch a dumbbell. You know, today we started with the muscle snatch, right? What's that look like? How do I dip and drive? How do I go from this internally rotated shoulder position, what we call the hang archetype, to this overhead position and express that normal range of motion functioning through the shoulder, transmitting energy through a stable and organized trunk? And it's easy to do that from a standing position. So what we're looking at is you'll see that a lot of the best coaches and athletes have already solved this problem. They don't know why they do it that way per se, but you know, spine first. Well, that means, hey, maybe we organize athletes in positions and shapes where they can be in a good spinal position and not compromise. It's not an accident that someone like Zach Evanesh, you know, will do a lot of prowler pushes and a lot of sled drags for conditioning, because you can get kids into really good positions that translate well to sport without lots of compensation.
And for those that might not be familiar with Coach Bergner, we're going to link it up, his famous warm-up. We'll link that up to the show notes, because that's, I think that's a good way to show the audience and the listeners what you're talking about right now as well.
And you know, what you'll see is that the Bergner warm-up does everything except for warm up the press position. So, he's got, you know, trunk control, isolated motor control of the shoulders. He's touching these fundamental shapes, right? And what you'll see is that if you did that warm-up, then it's a really excellent way of beginning to challenge and reinforce the fundamental positions that the shoulder has to be in for us to say that's a normal shoulder.
Let's say we have – this is – I usually get into trouble of asking very poor questions and then the guest saving me. so this is one of those. So let's say we have somebody that's kind of jacked up, right, that is really good at compensating. Or we can – let's take that push-up example that you had before with, you know, hyperextending their low back, their necks all over the place. How do we take somebody from that kind of, you know, jacked up position and get them to where they need to be?
Well, that's such a good question. And the first conversation is, well, are they making mistakes? Or are they making compensations because they don't know what a good position feels like? Mm-hmm. And we have a tool for this in the language of strength and conditioning. It's called slowing down. So oftentimes, you know, when someone says tempo, what you should be thinking is, wow, that's a skill to slow people down so they can feel what's going on. We do a lot of barefoot training in our gym to try to bring people's awareness back to what their foot pressure is in the shoe so they can actually have a reference position so their bodies can feel. And if you, as you know, as you're trying to work with a new athlete who doesn't have a long training age, they have no experience for what shapes they're in, what positions they're in. You know, they're just trying to hold on, and they're basically turning themselves into origami to achieve some arbitrary range of motion. And shame on the coach for not knowing what compensation begins to look like. So, you know, yes, you can butt wink for a while, but we got to run that experiment for a long time. And what'll end up happening is if you see an athlete losing their spinal stability and integration by hinging through a couple local segments over the long term, then what you are doing as a coach is being part of the problem. And what you're sacrificing is short-term gains, you know, and ego for long-term development of the athlete. And so, you know, in that position, we can slow people down. We can give tempo. And what we won't do is then challenge that position in a workout. So we won't say, hey, look, I see that you're doing terrible with the push-up. Good. Now let's go ahead and go race it on the clock as fast as we can, or just do tons of volume to reinforce that. And sometimes I had a woman today who's very strong, very capable, you know, and basically when she would receive the dumbbell overhead in the snatch, she would just hinge like a broken snake right in the middle of her back, you know? And mm-hmm. I was like, hey, this is the chance for you to reinforce this position. So I want you to slow down, catch this in a, receive this in a muscle snatch position, and then back yourself down into a quarter overhead squat with that dumbbell until you feel your back start to change shape. And she was like, wow, this is the first time I've been able to feel that. My physio has been telling me I've got to stop this problem, but I didn't understand what that looked like, right? So, you know, what we need to do is give people, we can still train. We're still going to train hard. She's doing resisted runs. We're breathing hard. We got her swinging heavy kettlebells. But this skill position, she needs to come to a place in her understanding of how her body moves where she can begin to feel the compensation and treat her inability to maintain the integrity of her positions as a failed concept. So if it's too heavy, it's very obvious that you're mm-hmm. going to have to go lighter, right? If the speed is too fast on the run, you're going to walk. If you can't maintain your shape, you need to do something. And that means either slow down or pull it out, or you may only be limited by your position. And I think what's happened is we've actually gotten to a place now where many of us are not limited by our lungs or our legs anymore. We're only limited by our ability to maintain our technique. And technique is shorthand for good expression of how the human being is supposed to work optimally. And that there's no debate about that. If you have a debate about what good forces are through the joint, you need to go back to biomechanics and physics, and then we can have that conversation once you've spun yourself up. But don't get me wrong, strategy is different than what the technique is. And if you are paying attention to our movement sciences, if you're paying attention to movement practices, then you understand why yoga is yoga and Pilates is Pilates and Olympic lifting is Olympic lifting, and why they all say the same thing about the shoulder.
So I just want to take a moment to all my friends and colleagues listening that Kelly just talked about barefoot training. The reason I bring that up is I tend to walk around in my bare feet at the gym.
And I'm standing in my gym barefoot right now.
And or sometimes I wear my Earth Runners, which are kind of minimalist sandals. But I always get weird looks and laughs, and like pause barefoot again. But so there you go, you know, ladies and gents.
Well, you know what's interesting? So check this out. Recently, I was at a high school. It's a high school we've worked with for the last 4 years. They use Supple Leopard as a textbook in their exercise physiology class.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they're doing a unit on running, and they just read Chris McDougall's wonderful book, Born to Run. And so we did a bunch of warm – had them take their shoes off. We squatted. We worked on foot mechanics. And then I said, okay, kids, after about 40 minutes of just working barefoot, I said, now put your shoes back on and achieve the same positions we were just in practicing. And all the kids were like, I can't feel the floor. Look what's happening in my feet. My arches are gone. Whoa. And I was like, okay, so now let's discuss which the shoe is the best shoe for you. And they said, oh, you mean the shoe that disrupts my foot the least? And I was like, correct. And now we have a model for understanding what is the best shoe. But if you can't feel what's happening to the ground, how can you possibly make good decisions about what's happening, how the athlete is moving? As a coach, you can't even see the feet. You can't see that the arches collapse. So if you're squatting and your and your arches are collapsed, and your foot is turned out, and the navicular bone is laying on the ground, and your toe is in a valgus position, so it looks like you have a bunion, then you are teaching compensation at a very fundamental position, which is where my athlete connects to the ground and how they generate force on the ground. Everything else is going to be bullshit. Everything else is bullshit. And what you're doing is just creating a problem that eventually we're going to have to unwind and solve ourselves.
You mentioned earlier that the world has changed, and we kind of use the kettlebell example that you couldn't even go down the street and get kettlebells. You have to drive down to Santa Cruz or get them ordered from Russia. My question to you is, you know, you've been named as, you know, one of the top 100 most influential people in health and fitness. You're basically everywhere, especially in strength and conditioning and CrossFit and whatnot. How have you changed the world? Would we be using barbells and kettlebells as mobility tools if you weren't around?
Well, you know, I think the yes, eventually someone would have solved these problems. You know, mm-hmm. Would people be distracting? Eventually, you know, would people be, you know, using, you know, so much of, you know, the work that I'm able to do now is predicated on the people who are holding the door open for us to create the change in consciousness. That's Dan John. That's Pavel. That's Greg Glassman. You know, Mark Verstegen. If people like, you know, Gunnar Peterson, if these guys weren't holding the door open and talking about the first order of change, then we couldn't have the next conversation. We would have a culture that isn't ready to be thinking about these things. If you can buy Olympic lifting shoes everywhere. When I started Olympic lifting, I was driving to South San Francisco. It would be about a 40-minute drive. I would lift with an old Olympic coach named Jim Schmitz, and he would charge you $50 a month for the programming. And, you know, in order to buy shoes, you'd go on the internet and, you know, people were like, oh, we don't have size 11. Sorry. You know, and you just couldn't, you buy shoes out of the back of someone's car. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like, what is this? This is so weird. And if those coaches hadn't been holding the door open, if guys like Dick Hertzel and Louis Simmons and the masters out there, you know, Donnie Thompson, if they hadn't created the first language, then we wouldn't have been able to write the poems that we've been able to write. So, you know, people are so clever, and you know, I think people have been obsessed with going faster and being more efficient forever, but we had to get to a conversation where, you know, there's a critical mass of us doing these things so we could have the next conversation. Does it help that I'm a physio? Yes. I would not see the world the way I do if I hadn't gone to physio school. But conversely, if I was just a physio and not a strength coach, I also wouldn't be able to see or understand what's going on. So, you know, I would say that I am very fortunate to have the right partner. My wife is the CEO and brilliant. Mm-hmm. To have grown up in the umbrella of CrossFit, where I had access to people like Mike Bergner and Coach Ripito and Greg Glassman and Brian McKenzie and John Wellborn, and that these are, you know, my influences at the right time with the right skill set. So, you know, early on in physio school, you know, we opened the gym in the end of my first year of physio school. So I was a grad student, I had a baby, and then we are officially now the 21st CrossFit in the world. So if you count down the list, I think we're like 21 on the list. And what you'll see is I got to see a lot of people squat and press, you know, thousands of athlete sessions. And because I had thousands of athlete sessions, I could see patterns on a higher order of magnitude. And the same thing is true now. I think, you know, if you look at the things we were talking about 10 years ago, they're very different than the things we're talking about today. Why? Because the entire world has become more sophisticated. Why? Because there's such a thing called Orange Theory, and there's such a thing called, you know, high intensity exercises out there. It's not going away. So have I changed the world? You know, we'll let you know in 20 years. But in the meantime, what I'll say is that I'm fortunate that I have come of age at a time where we were ready for this conversation, mm-hmm. where the sports, where the world had changed, and the loci of control had shifted back to the person, right? Rob Wolf, nutrition around that, John Berardi, where we had experts in all of these different fields. And we add on the fact that, you know, so many masters have been holding the door open for us for so long that we could have the next conversation.
So speaking of masters, you're essentially, and from, you know, from my perspective, you are becoming that individual. You know, you are becoming the Dick Herzl, the Donnie Thompson, the John Wellborn that people, you know, come and learn from and train with. Who are some people that you had that are up and coming that we might not know about that we should be on the lookout for?
I tell you, I don't know if it's up and coming, but mm-hmm. I think important is going to be continue to refine our ability to teach. Mm-hmm. So I think now our average coach has a very high technical understanding of GPP, general mm-hmm. physical preparedness training. You know, our gym, we have 150, 160 hour formal internship process, you know, where you are one-on-one with a coach mm-hmm. working and teaching. You know, we have it's a long internship to be able to coach with us, come through our internship program, plus all the formal training, you know, from my courses and, you know, Diane Fu's barbell course, et cetera, et cetera. What I'll say is that the average beginner coach now sort of has all this advanced alien technology, but doesn't understand how to make fire with two sticks. You know what I mean? So. Yeah. So on the one hand, what we need to continue to do for those coaches is give them just continued volume of experience. There is no substitution for, you know, for putting your paddle in the water and pulling on it a million times. You're going to learn a lot. And that means you just need to get into the teaching, right? You may be a very expert beginner, but you're still a beginner. You know, you might have a Leonardo da Vinci understanding of program design, but you literally just don't have the hours and the repetition seeing it and seeing different people in different positions. So pattern recognition takes time to develop. But in that has been lost this art of communication, of mm-hmm. teaching, of transmitting information. What you'll see is that there's more and more conversation about being good at that. And someone like Brett Bartholomew and his art of coaching, I think what you're going to see is we are going to have to become better at the sort of software component to this, which is how do I communicate? How do I teach? How to refine? You know, how do I get to the rapport more effectively with my athletes? There's a coach named Fergus Connolly who's wrote a book called Game Changer.
Yes.
Fergus is thinking at a level that most of us aren't aware of exists. So he's thinking about in patterns and where do these things fit in the context of principle, and how he is working and manipulating really helps us get through the noise. And so someone like that, we suddenly have this really incredible, his book Game Changer, I can't recommend enough. I would look at Conscious Coaching by Brett Bartholomew and think in those terms that, you know, there's not going to be a secret snatch technique now that gets us. We're beyond that. We're in a kind of post Klokov world, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where people become very sophisticated and there's so many wonderful people teaching in so many different ways. It's going to become about how we manage environmental load, how we get, you know, more work out of the athlete, how do we get the athlete to recover more quickly, you know, and then really you're going to have to become an expert in things like nutrition and downregulation. So, but the soft side, I mean, those two, I'd throw one more piece out that sometimes we take the fundamentals for granted, but if I was making the case for understanding roots of human movement, I would say it's running, jumping, and throwing. And that sounds and smells a lot like track and field. And I would look at what the guys at Altus are doing, Stuart McMillan. They have a basic coaching platform for understanding running, jumping, and throwing that I think would be really useful for all coaches. So get out of your muscle up, ring dip, functional training world and go see how other people are teaching complex skills in other domains. other sports and how they're communicating about those things, and I guarantee you'll come back a much more savvy integrated coach.
And can you spell that for me, Kelly? Altus, A-L-T-U-S? Is that how you spell it?
Yep, that's it.
All right, perfect.
Cool. Or it's A-L-T-I-S.
A-L-T-I-S. All right, just so we get that down. Perfect. We actually have a gentleman coming on the podcast that has worked both with you and Fergus on your books, and that is Phil White. So just a quick preview. Heads up.
Excellent.
You mentioned Julie, like I mentioned, Mobility Wad and anything related has become a behemoth of knowledge and resources. What role has Julie played in your success and in the growth of Mobility Wad and everything that you guys do?
Well, you know, you're talking about the CEO and my wife, and you know, what I'd say is, you know, she is the greatest partner I ever had. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can't, none of this exists without her. So mm-hmm. You know, what degree, it's 50%, you know, in terms of everything from running the gym to, you know, understanding how we're going to communicate on social media to what our long-term strategy is. You know, the key here is, you know, a lot of coaches are really brilliant, but they're not really good at answering emails, you know? And if I came back to that principle about, you know, the sort of the underrated aspects of coaching, which is communication and follow through. And, you know, what I'll say is, you know, Juliet is an expert in there, and by default, I benefit greatly by her expertise. You know, Juliet, people forget that she was a high level attorney at a big law firm before she left that job to come, you know, work full time on the family business. And one of the things that we're going to have to continue to do is to develop and reinforce high level executive skill. This is why someone like Fergus Connolly, you know, Greg Cook, Brett Bartholomew, anyone who's ever written a book, you know, or started a program, will never cast a stone at anyone else who's done the same thing. You'll see that anyone who has got their shit together to a place where you can write a book, create a course, support other coaches, will respect that in someone else, and they won't spend their time trashing anyone else. They'll talk about what they do, but you know, that high level of executive function is miraculous and unicorn-like. And what I would say to anyone who's interested in trying to grow a business is to go marry someone named Juliet.
Got it. If we were to hop on a plane together, we don't know each other. I know nothing about you.
Oh, that's not true at all. That is an untrue statement. I know how you train. I know how you eat. I know what shoes you wear. I know what you think about in your free time. I know if you have a sauna, you have access to an ice bath. I know that you're eating. I mean, there's so much that we know about each other, right?
But hypothetically, say we don't. And we're flying. Let's say, let's pick a place. What's a place that you love flying to or traveling to?
Hawaii.
All right. Which island?
Kauai or Oahu.
All right. Let's go Kauai because I've had the fortune of going there a couple times. And we're flying there out of LAX. And I get to sit next to you. And I say, hey, Kelly, so what do you do for a living? What is your response?
It's complicated. I think for the average person, I say I'm a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, and then, and I, or I just say I'm a physical therapist or a human performance coach. You know, it's one of those things. You know, it's probably all of those things. You know, so if you, you know, people aren't ready for the full download. They just aren't. So you can have the first conversation. You know, sometimes I say I'm a coach. You know. Sometimes I just say I'm a physical therapist, and then if they're ready to have the next conversation, we'll do that. Otherwise, you know, how do you explain all this to someone? You know, when someone comes into our gym, how do I explain that, you know, they're going to learn like 5 Olympic sports, they're going to pull out a lot of refined carbohydrate out of their diet, they're going to stop drinking, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot of things that are going to happen, you know, around this. And, but you can't give them that full dose day one. You can't tell them, you know, yeah, I know you don't really care about your deadlift PR, but you will, you know, we don't have that conversation day one. You know, what we say is, you know, hey, have a good time, be cool. You know, so, you know, I think the second you stop, you know, being a generalist, it's a mistake. So even if you are a high-level sprint coach or a high-level receiving coach, or you do a specific thing, you're a sprint coach, you know, the second you stop trying to understand what other people are doing, and you don't have to have their technical understanding, right? But you need to be a generalist, because it is going to influence how you think and how you coach. And you should be continuing to be obsessed and be an avid reader. You know, recently I've been reading a couple things where, you know, it just turns out that everyone who's good is obsessively studying and trying to understand how other people are thinking and doing their job. You know, and I read in every other field I can think of that's interesting to me besides the one I'm in. You know, because it turns out that just teaches me and informs so much about how I think and solve problems around me.
What do you love about Hawaii?
Oh, I just feel complete there. Mm-hmm. my wife and I were professional paddlers and still are. Yeah. I mean, last, like a week and a half ago, I just did Race Molokai again.
Okay, and, very cool.
Which is a 50-kilometer open ocean race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I'm in Hawaii, there's something about the sun. There's something about the food. You know, I think the problem is I probably don't live in Hawaii because I would die of mercury poisoning from the fish. And I'd get skin cancer because I'd be burned all the time. But, you know, there's something about when I'm there that, you know, makes me feel like it's really sustainable, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's just the change, you know. Andrew Huberman, Huberman Labs, he's worked with Brian McKenzie on Art of Breath, and he's an expert in neuroplasticity. You know, he says one of the ways that we can rewire our brains is to change our environment. You know, and you've had this experience where you go travel and everything smells different and mm-hmm. everything tastes different and everything feels different. Then you come back and you're a little bit aware of the weather and how everything smells. And that's a good example, I think, of, you know, when we travel. But also, I think when I get to go there, I get to play a lot. I do a lot of paddling. I do a lot of training. My wife and I know we're on vacation when we do a sport and train in the same day. That's how we know we're on vacation.
What do you mean by complete? Because I think that's an interesting thread that I want to pull.
I feel like I'm getting enough sunshine on my body. I sleep a lot. You know, I'm able to easily get, you know, 8.5 hours of sleep.
Okay.
And then, you know, like I said, I get to play. You know, one of the narratives that's lost in this language of strength conditioning and mm-hmm. human performance is the gym is not the point, you know, and for better or worse, CrossFit is mucked that up a little bit mm-hmm. and is even trying themselves to just unravel that what you'll see is that there's a lot of thinking in the world that is predicated on just getting better in the gym. And there's a lot of satisfaction to that. And Instagram tells us that that's really important, but the gym was a place to train so that we could go do something else. And in sports like Olympic lifting and gymnastics confuse that, even powerlifting, because the sport is taking place in the gym. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of us, the reason we went to the gym was to find problems, to remedy weaknesses, to improve conditioning so that we could go take that and go spend that out in the world doing whatever else. And there are times in your life where all you have is training in the gym, and thank goodness for that. But then we have to try to remember that the point of the gym was to go not just be healthier. And for some of us, it is. It's the only place, it's the sport that we have, and that's okay. But that kind of thinking can be detrimental because it potentially is recursive. That means as long as I just do more squats, it doesn't matter how I do more squats. And so for us, for example, you know, we teach a really straight foot position in a lot of our movements. And the reason we do is that that's how you run. That's how you jump. That's how you bike. So if you're trying to make me a better cyclist, but you're only teaching me to extend my hip with my feet turned out, what do you think the pattern is going to be when I try to extend my foot on the bike? I'm going to turn my heels in. I can't pedal my bike like a duck, right? So what we're seeing is we want to ask the questions in the gym, how do these positions and shapes transfer to being a more effective mover in the world? And if I'm always turning my feet out for everything I do because I don't have ankle range of motion or no one has said that this is important, right, and I continue to compensate with the foot turned out position, then what happens is that I'm going to be in the world and I'm going to turn my feet out, you know, and that doesn't work all the time when I'm running and cutting and jumping and landing and sprinting. So well, you know, you can't ski like a duck. So why are you training your body to be in those fundamental shapes? And if you tell me it doesn't transfer, then I'll tell you that you don't understand why we bench press in the first place. So, you know, the goal here is, can we get back into the world and improve our function in the world? And that usually isn't through sports. And if you look even at CrossFit's Fitness in 100 Worlds or Less, it was really a methodology about trying to train so that you could go out and learn a new skill, learn a new sport. And GPP in itself is general physical preparedness. Preparedness for what? More preparedness? So, you know, I think what we want to make sure is that we're reminding people that you should take this incredible skill set and go spend it. And when I'm in Hawaii, I guarantee I do that.
Yeah, and it's a realization that took me a while to come to, and I think it actually my wife and I just got back from Iceland and spent 2 weeks there traveling the country, and what you just mentioned kind of clicked to me finally, and she's been very good to me in terms of reminding me as well that, hey, what you're doing inside the gym, it should be translating to what we're doing here. We're hiking to this beautiful valley. You know, how are you extending your hips? How are you positioning your feet? You know, is this what you're doing in the gym? And if not, why not? Because if you might, you know, trip up or not properly set your hip or your feet. So it does tie in together beautifully, but you first have to come to that recognition and that realization that it is tied together and it does translate beautifully, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and again, it's a later conversation to have, because if you can't do a pull-up, you know, or five strict push-ups, then we still have issues. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally agree.
And I think it's easy to use it as apologetics, you know, but, you know, what we're trying to do is create more capable beings so that we are more resilient, so that we can handle accidents. Let me give you an example. One of my best friends, Brian McKenzie, just knocked himself out recently, like, you know, a week ago, basically was climbing on a jungle gym and stood up underneath a bar and compressed his neck straight down, and it really knocked him out, just kind of turned him off. And then he backflipped off, landed on his neck, and he ended up only with a herniated disc, not a fractured neck, not anything else. And some of being really, really strong and mobile, I mean, that he, bad things when they happen to you, you know, and we can say that, hey, that's the same thing about health. You know, your blood pressure is the example that, you know, CrossFit uses a lot. But, you know, your blood panel, all of that. But, you know, some of it is just to be more resilient, to have so that when bad things happen, you've got the range of motion, you've got the tendon health, you've got the connective tissue health to be able to withstand that. And with injury, catastrophe, car accidents, you know, accidents, sport injuries, you know, bad things happen. So, you know, the gym, again, is about many things, but most of it is about our expression in the world. Besides, do we have abs or no abs?
No, definitely agree. I'm not going to let you go or get away with this, get out of this interview without me asking this question. And I want to start winding down a little bit, but I had this question prepared, so I want to make sure I asked. Is that we, believe it or not, we actually have something very, very in common without you knowing, but we actually grew up fairly close to each other. It was actually about a 9-hour drive. I grew up in Szczecin in Western Poland. And if I'm not mistaken, you grew up in, and I apologize if I mispronounce this, but it's a Garmisch.
That's it.
An hour south of Munich in Germany. So a lot of people don't travel to Germany for whatever reason. A lot of people don't get to experience that culture. So for those that haven't yet or don't know much about it, what are some things that people should know about Germany and maybe take a chance and take a trip out there sometime?
Well, what I can speak to was growing up in Bavaria in the mountains, you know, it was the home of the 72 Winter Olympics, is that everyone was active. The infrastructure was set up so you could ride your bike everywhere. Everyone kayaked, everyone biked, everyone skied, everyone hiked. You know, there were just local Volksmarches, which are like little walks where you get a medal and drink tea and you walk around, tour the country. You know, that physical activity is sort of just baked into the average person. I mean, there was on Frühlingsstraße, which is Spring Street, this really well-known, very historic kind of part of the local village, there was a woman who I bet was 100 years old who rode her bike every day. She was bent in half, just like huge hunchback, but 100 years old, crushing on her bike. And, you know, recently Joe Rogan tweeted out something that had come to his attention, and it was a picture of an MRI of a 74-year-old guy, and you could see all the fat in his legs and the tiny muscles, and then a 70-year-old triathlete who had very little fat on his leg and 100% muscle, the same diameter leg. And, you know, what I learned a lot as a kid was that everyone was good at everything, that you could climb and you could hike and you could run and you could bike and you could ski. And the value was to be a really well-rounded athlete. And, you know, I'm grateful that I grew up on a mountain bike and I grew up sort of having these activities just as a part of daily living. And, you know, I think imprinted upon me, you know, everyone, you know, had a huge aerobic base because that's what it took to go play. And it was not something you even necessarily train that much because that's what you did. You know, my friends and I would ride our bikes, you know, 50K on the weekend just to, you know, on a Saturday just to get, you know, chocolate at the border of Austria. You know what I mean? So, you know, and that wasn't a big deal for 12-year-olds to ride a 50K. It was just something we did. And I think, you know, what I really appreciate about that was we always ate good food. You know, we played our brains out. And that freedom, I think, really did shape. You know, I've talked about this before, but being at a high level ski racing camp in Austria, and you know, that was my first introduction to very technical level coaching. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think if none of that exists, I'm not sure I exist.
Got it. So you mentioned something interesting. A couple of interesting things, and something that my wife and I actually noticed when we were in Iceland recently, is this whole fascinating idea of being active and being active at a young age. We saw kids on their bicycles riding around, walking to the store. Something as simple as just young kids, probably, you know, maybe 10 or 11, maybe even younger, walking to the grocery store by themselves. You know, getting groceries. Just being active, playing, or just walking, you know, longer distances. And that seems to have been a stark contrast into what is happening or what has happened in the U.S. And to try to maybe wrap this up in a tie a nice bow on our conversation is this, what to me appears as a significant problem in our culture, is this, I'm looking forward to this kind of deactivization of our youth or just our population.
Yeah. I tell you, you know, who's written about this a lot is a woman named Katie Bowman, who wrote a book called Move Your DNA.
We actually ran into her on a hike in Iceland.
Oh, so there you go.
It's interesting that you say that. Yeah. We talked about that as well.
Katie has an example in her book, Move Your DNA, about orcas and orca whales in captivity. And she points out that, you know, when you change the behavior of the orca, by putting them in captivity, one of the things they do is they spend a lot more time at the surface, which exposes the dorsal fin to a lot larger gravitational moment arm, right? So it has the effects of gravity on the dorsal fin when it's always out of the water is stronger than it's swimming. Second thing is that you don't see the orca swim as fast or as vigorously as it does in the open ocean, covering thousands and thousands of miles. And so subsequently, the fin isn't exposed to the loading that necessary to maintain a strong fin. So the combination of having a weakened fin because it's not swimming and gravity leads to this thing called folded fin syndrome, where the fin drapes over. And that's a good example for what's happening to our bodies in our modern worlds, is that we're not loading them. So the tissues physically have to be loaded in order to express. So if you want a healthy disc in your back, you have to load the disc beyond just, you know, sitting and walking to the refrigerator. It takes more hinging and loading and jumping and landing, and you know, you can see what the yogis were trying to do in terms of trying to get that to load. Look what Joseph Pilates was doing, you know, and when you even come back to some of the oldest strength conditioning, it's carries, right? It's drags. It's very, very, very simple, elegant programming. But what's happening to us is that we are moving less, and we're moving less robustly, and we're not solving, you know. And so what's happening in the gym is we're trying to remedy all of that by building a training age in the gym. It's like taking, hey, I'm just going to eat chips and pizza, and then I'll just take all my vitamins at home in the evening, right? And that's a little bit what's going on. So eventually, as a culture, we're going to have to think differently about how we exist, and that's easy. You need to walk more, you know, you need to sleep more, you need to eat more whole foods, you know. Even if all of our lead athletes, if they one of the biggest mistakes we see, for example, they just don't walk around enough during the day. And one of the things that will change, if you hit that 10 to 15,000 steps a day, you'll see that your tissues will be better. You'll be able to clear and decongest more effectively. You'll sleep better. So, you know, we can't get it all done in an hour. Mm. It's the whole scope of the thing, given enough time. And I think that's the way of wrapping your head around this. It's not saying, hey, let's pine for the olden days. But what we need to do is be outside and play and move a lot more than we are.
All right, man. What is next for you? What is on the horizon, long term and short term?
I'm paddling the Grand Canyon in a couple weeks. I'll be in Europe next week. You know, we're just going to continue. We have a few books in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. We're working to try to continue to try to support the amazing coaches and athletes we see everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we'll get there. You know, this is a long, long game. And, you know, ultimately, I want to spend more time with my kids.
Fantastic. So if for some reason there's somebody that's new to strength and conditioning or CrossFit or Olympic weightlifting, and they heard of you on our podcast, hopefully, where can people find you?
We are at Mobility Wad, workout of the day, on all the social handles. MobilityWad.com gives you all access to everything we need. We have a free 10-day trial on the site. And one of the things that we do is we're trying to get everyone to do a little soft tissue work, put a mm-hmm. little sensory motor input in. At the end of the day, we do daily follow along mobility videos. So we really try to help people integrate these practices into what we understand is really complexity. Their lives are busy. You know, people are working really, really hard. What we need to do is help them simplify all of this so they can lead a better life without feeling so crazy.
Fantastic. Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it. And more so, thank you for being a wonderful teacher and a mentor and a resource for not only me, but a lot of the athletes and coaches that I work with, man.
Absolutely my pleasure. We're just getting started. We finally understand a little bit now, so we can have the next conversation. So hang in there with us.
Fantastic. Another amazing episode in the books, fam. If you enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. If you are new to the show, don't be afraid to check out other episodes. And if you dig the content, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. If you ever have any questions, feedback, or you just want to hit us up, please don't hesitate. Email address is contact@unchartedperformance, or you can hit me up directly at powell@unchartedperformance.com. Facebook and Instagram at Uncharted Performance, and if Twitter is your thing, at Reach Uncharted. And give us a follow and tag us to let us know who and where you are. As always, thank you for listening and supporting the podcast, and talk to you next week. Cheers, guys.